Going to continue in Matthew chapter 5 this morning as we continue our series on the upside down kingdom, Sermon on the Mount. And I originally thought as I looked at this particular lesson, I thought about combining it a bit with the lesson that we had last week. If you remember last week, we talked about lust and Jesus' words in Matthew chapter 5 regarding lust and adultery. And sometimes those are easily combined with this next subject that he hits in the next few verses on divorce. But I thought, you know, these are really important subjects for us to consider separately. But before we get into Matthew 5, 31 and 32, I want to hit on something that we kind of talked about last week, and I left maybe open-ended, and I want to just kind of address it because it's a common question that comes up when we talk about lust. We talked a lot about pornography last week and kind of how Jesus addresses the crowds, and whereas they had previously thought about adultery being a physical act only, Jesus says, no, it goes deeper than that into the heart of the person. And he defines unfaithfulness even so far as the thoughts that sometimes grab our attention and occupy our minds. And, you know, I've had people ask me this question. They're dealing with maybe a spouse who is involved in pornography. And been deeply addicted to this thing, and this spouse will ask the question, you know, is this grounds for divorce? Is my husband, my wife's addiction to pornography, adultery? Does that qualify in the Bible as divorce? And I want to address that question because I didn't address it last week, and that's one that gets debated a lot. Maybe you were asking that question sitting here. Maybe that's your story and your situation that you find yourself in today. And we'll talk a little bit more about why I'm going to give you this short answer that's really complicated. If we have more time, we could talk about it. But I don't believe that an addiction to pornography in of itself is grounds for divorce. I think Jesus makes note of some things in Matthew chapter 5 that are important for us to understand about adultery. That adultery kind of has two components, heart adultery and physical adultery. We talked about both of those last week. One leads to the other. You don't have physical adultery without heart adultery. Right? It's already happened in the heart before it becomes an action that is lived out in life. But sometimes we might look at heart adultery and say, well, if they're unfaithful in their mind, then they're unfaithful. And that's giving me grounds for divorce. And while I don't want to belittle an addiction to pornography, because addiction to pornography and that kind of a struggle is very real and very difficult for a spouse, especially of one struggling to go through, because there's all sorts of detachment and marital problems that result and all sorts of things that we could talk about. So I don't want to belittle that, but I also believe that Jesus' words that we're going to read today, as he discusses the act of adultery and divorce, there's a difference between lusting in your mind and physically acting it out in your life. There's a switch that somehow gets turned off and on when someone goes to the next step to act that out and to physically live the unfaithfulness that's been going on in their mind out in their life. And so, in short, I don't believe that it's necessarily grounds for divorce, addiction to pornography alone, although I believe it is wrong. Both of those are wrong. So we're going to talk a little bit more about adultery this morning and a divorce, a sensitive topic. Okay, I don't walk into this thing blind and unaware that this is where we've all been in a lot of ways, where we all are, maybe in some ways in our marriages, because marriage is hard, isn't it? Marriage is tough. You know, one of the things that they don't tell you, or you just ignore it when you first get married because you're so happy to get married, is how much work this is. You know, I remember the first year we were married, kind of a few months in maybe, or a year in, thinking, man, this is great, but this is tough too. You know, they don't tell you all the things that you have to get used to about the other person, some of the unexpected ways of getting used to. I know, I'm being careful with this one here. Getting used to the different habits that each other has, the different expectations that you might have, and even revealing your own nastiness sometimes. You know? You don't realize sometimes until you start interacting with that other individual, man, that's, I didn't realize it could be that mean, that angry, that nasty, that, you know, whatever it is, or fly off the handle that quickly. And Abby, to this day, still denies the fact that she has threatened me in her sleep before, but it's true. Abby does not like to be messed with when she's tired, just to, so you know. And she does say mean things when she's grumpy and asleep. All that being said, though, Jesus, Matthew chapter 5, enters the topic of divorce and infidelity. And on the heels of his teaching about lust, in Matthew chapter 5, 31, he says, "It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the grounds of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." Pretty straightforward teaching, really. We could almost stop there this morning and just say, that's it. Really simple, plain, and cut and dry. Jesus says, if you divorce your spouse for anything but adultery or infidelity, you make them and you commit adultery. And no grounds for divorce except for infidelity, unfaithfulness. But it's a pretty radical statement. It's not that easy. In life, as it is today, as it was back then, it was a pretty radical statement to say. And apparently this caused quite a bit of stir among the Jews, that Jesus would say it this boldly, this kind of cut and dried. Because in Matthew 19, the next passage we're actually going to be in this morning, the Pharisees approached Jesus. And either they were there when he made the initial statement on divorce and adultery in Matthew chapter 5, and they have some additional questions for Jesus, or they've kind of heard people talking about what Jesus' approach is on this thing, and they want to confront him on this. And so in Matthew chapter 19, our text for today, we have this better developed treatise on divorce and adultery that Jesus kind of explains in more detail a little bit about what he has said and what he means. And so I'm going to ask if you would just turn to Matthew chapter 19, and we're going to read 1 through 12 together. Matthew 19, 1 through 12. "Now when Jesus had finished these sayings, he went away from Galilee and entered the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And large crowds followed him there, and he healed them there. And the Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, 'Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?' He answered, 'Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate.' They said to him, 'Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away?' He said to them, because of your hardness of your heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery.' The disciples said to him, 'If such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry.' But he said to them, 'Not everyone can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive this receive it." I'm going to tell a little bit on myself with my mom here this morning. When we were kids growing up, my sister and I, we lived in a neighborhood. And it was kind of a neighborhood in the middle of nowhere, actually. It was outside of town, kind of an odd spot for a neighborhood. It was in the middle of a bunch of cornfields and soybean fields. But here we were in the middle of this neighborhood. It was a little neighborhood. It really wasn't that big. It was basically a figure eight, an oval with a slash in the middle as far as the streets go. We lived on the middle street. And being concerned parents, my mom and dad, when we were little, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, they really tried to limit our travels throughout the neighborhood to just our street. He said, "Don't go up on the next street unless you ask our permission." So we would ride our bikes up and down in front of our house. And problem was that our friends didn't live on our street. We really didn't have a whole lot of kids that we hung out with on that street. And so we would have to go to the next street a lot to hang out and play with friends. And so every so often, I'm sure you've never done this, or your kids have never done this to you, but we would be playing, you know, in our yard. It would be a Saturday, and one of the kids would say, "Hey, let's go play football in my yard. We've got a bigger backyard." So we'd go over to Kyle or Ian's house, and we'd play football. And then, you know, the realization that, oh, I should have asked permission from mom and dad. I didn't do that. And so at some point, we'd kind of wander our way back to the house, and we'd pop our head in the door and say, "Hey, Mom and Dad, can we go over to Kyle and Ian's house?" "Yeah, sure, that's fine. Thanks for asking." Great. Kind of retroactively kind of covering ourselves, right? You've never done that before, have you? You know, they say it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. At least that's the quote, I guess, from some folks. But sometimes we do this. Sometimes we already have done things. We've already held opinions about things. And then we kind of test the waters with people and ask them questions that appear as though we haven't figured it out yet, or we're still debating this issue, or we're still making a decision, when reality is that we've already made the decision. And that's where we find ourselves with the Pharisees in chapter 19. They ask Jesus some questions. And as we start hearing the questions that they're asking, and we see the response of Jesus and the response of the Pharisees, we get the idea that the Pharisees already had their own opinions about some of this stuff. And so they ask Jesus, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" Now, for us to understand a little bit about where the Pharisees are coming from, it's important to understand the climate of Jewish teaching in the first century on divorce and remarriage. There's actually a division in thought at the time about what to do with this commandment of divorce and remarriage. And it fell along two rabbis who gained quite a big following of their own on their respective teachings. The rabbi Shammai and Hillel were popular right before Jesus comes on the scene in the early first century. And they kind of established the main two schools of thought with regards to divorce and remarriage. Shammai taught a strict interpretation of the law. And as we hear Jesus give his opinion on this and his teaching, really, from God's Word, it seems as though Jesus would fall in line with Rabbi Shammai's opinion about the law on this particular issue. The school of Hillel took a more liberal approach and to divorce and remarriage, and as we hear the Pharisees and see their responses, it seems as though they probably subscribe to Rabbi Hillel's teaching. Hillel, over time, became the more popular approach. Shammai kind of fell out of favor with the people on this particular issue. And so by Jesus' day, first century Judaism, divorce was rampant. If you go back and read some of these rabbis and some of the things that they taught, quoting Rabbi Hillel, you might be surprised as to all the ways that you could justify a divorce in the first century in Judaism. Josephus was a historian, Jewish historian, who lived at the time of Jesus. He was married four times. Two of his wives died. Two of them were divorced. And on one particular occasion, he writes about one of those divorces, saying that he was divorcing his wife for not being pleased with her behavior. Ben Sira, a rabbi about 200 years prior to Jesus, is famous for his quote about divorce and a wife: "If she does not go as you would have her go, cut her off from your flesh and give her a bill of divorce and let her go." Rabbi Akiba, another rabbi, after Jesus is dead, is quoted as saying, "If any man saw a woman handsomer than his own wife, he might put his wife away, because it is said in the law, if she find not favor in his eyes." And so you kind of got the idea that, man, there's just any kind of old reason that you could give, from "she's not pretty enough," "she didn't do what I said," "she didn't do this right," even something as simple as burning a meal under the thought of Rabbi Hillel was justified means of divorce. And you kind of have to scratch your head and think, well, man, this has kind of gone a little sideways, hasn't it? This has kind of got off track. And so the Pharisees come to Jesus and ask this question: "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" Jesus says, "No. No, you can't. Have you not read," verse 4, he says, "have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." Jesus goes all the way back to the beginning. Genesis chapter 2, the creation, the institution of marriage itself, and quotes from the very words of God and God's commentary on His creation as He created man and woman, and says you can't separate them. Because essentially what happens when a man and woman get married, they consummate their marriage, they no longer are two people. They are one flesh. The sexual union creates them and makes them one. You cannot separate them. It's impossible. In 2008, a movie came out that maybe many of you have seen. It was a Christian-based movie, but actually gained some traction in secular theaters and paved the way for a lot of the Christian movies that we see today. Fireproof was a movie on a marriage that was struggling. Kirk Cameron stars as the guy who has a marriage on the rocks, and his friend Ken Bevel plays his friend, and Ken's the Christian guy that's trying to get Kirk to reconsider some of the actions that he's going to take in his marriage to free himself of this obligation that's become so debilitating in his life and the rough road that his marriage has been. In this clip I'm going to show you next, really Ken, and the turning point of the movie is where Ken and Kirk have this discussion about marriage and what happens when you get married and what the danger of divorce becomes, the casualties of divorce become, in the famous salt and pepper shaker scene in the movie Fireproof. And we're going to play that if we can here in just a second.
40 days.
Catherine, no?
I'm not going to tell her. If she wants to go ahead and file, that's up to her.
Divorce is a hard thing, man.
Well, if it brings peace.
But Caleb, you want the right kind of peace.
What do you mean by that?
You know what that ring on your finger means?
It means I'm married.
Yeah, well, it also means you made a lifelong covenant. You were putting on that ring while saying your vows. The sad part about it is, when most people promise for better or for worse, they really only mean for the better.
Catherine and I were in love when we got married, but today, we're two very different people, all right? It's just not working out anymore.
Caleb, salt and pepper are completely different. Their makeup is different, their taste and their color. But you always see them together. And when you... Hold on just a second.
What are you doing? Michael. Hey. What'd you do that for?
Caleb, when two people get married, it's for better or for worse, for richer or for poor, in sickness and in health.
I know that, but marriages aren't fireproof. Sometimes you get burned.
Fireproof doesn't mean that a fire will never come, but that when it comes, you'll be able to withstand it.
You didn't have to glue them together.
Don't do it, Caleb. If you pull them apart now, you'll break either one or both of them.
I am not a perfect person, but better than most. And if my marriage is failing, it is not all my fault.
But Caleb, man, I've seen you run into a burning building and save people you don't even know. But you're going to let your own marriage just burn to the ground.
Michael, you are my friend. And I've allowed you to speak freely with me on this job. Don't abuse it.
In so many ways, a great illustration of marriage. Breaking either one or both of them, Ken says, you can't pull these apart without damaging one or both. I've done weddings before where instead of a unity candle, the couples choose to do sand as symbolizing their marriage covenant together. And so they both have come to the wedding with two jars of different colored sand, and they pour those jars together to symbolize their marriage. And I often have thought, in reflecting about that illustration, how difficult it would be to go back through that container of sand and pull all of those colors back out again and put them back where they were. It's nearly impossible. You'd almost surely end up with less sand in one or both of those and different colors mixed together because you can't do it. And so Jesus tells the Pharisees, when we marry, God no longer sees two people. When we marry, God no longer sees Scott and Abby. He sees the McFarlands. He no longer sees Jeff and Myrna. He sees the Benningers. He no longer sees Keith and Tina. He sees the Joneses. Not two, but one flesh. Divorce was not a new problem in Jesus' day. It was a problem in the Old Testament as well. If you go back to Malachi chapter 2, Malachi, in his commentary on the situation at present with the Israelite people, speaking for God in verse 13 of chapter 2, Malachi says, "And this second thing you do, you cover the Lord's altar with tears, with weeping and groaning, because He no longer regards the offering or accepts it with favor from your hand. But you say, why does He not? Because the Lord was witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Did He not make them one with a portion of the Spirit in their union? And what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring. So guard yourselves in your spirit and let none of you be faithless to the wife of your youth. For the man who does not love his wife but divorces her, says the Lord, the God of Israel, covers his garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. So guard yourselves in your spirit and do not be faithless." The Israelites have become flippant in their views of divorce and remarriage, and God says it's affecting your offerings, it's affecting the way you worship me. Because the fact is that when God enters that union, when two people get married, God was witness to the covenant. God is not just there as an observer. Malachi chapter 2 says that God is in the midst of the covenant itself. It's between two people and God. He says, "Did He not make them one with a portion of the Spirit in their union?" And so God exists in the middle of Abby and I's marriage. It's not just Abby and I. God exists in Corey and Luenda's marriage. It's not just Corey and Luenda. The same with your spouse. And so if God is in the middle of our marriage covenant, divorce becomes a lot trickier. Because now you're not just divorcing two people, you're divorcing two people and God and the covenant that you three have made together. The Pharisees come back with a question. They say, "But didn't Moses give allowance for a certificate of divorce? Why then, verse 7, did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away?" The Pharisees were kind of keying off of a passage in Deuteronomy chapter 24 where Moses talks about a man finding some indecency with a wife, and it's very vague. Moses said the only thing necessary would be to send her away with a certificate of divorce. And this passage had historically, by Jesus' day, been used to justify that frivolous attitude towards divorce that was commonplace. Just give her the divorce papers and send her off. All you got to do is write it down and document it. It's basically the attitude that was said. But Jesus said, you know why Moses did this? You know why he told you that you could give her a certificate of divorce? Because your hearts were hard. Verse 8. "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery." Because your hearts are hard, Moses allowed you and gave you an exception. Essentially, Jesus says, because you were unable to adhere to the standard that God had set from the very beginning, Moses allowed you this exception. But it wasn't this way in the beginning. Marriage was designed to be permanent. God and to His children coming together in a covenant relationship, the only condition for divorce being sexual unfaithfulness, when one person outside of that covenant relationship enters into that covenant and breaks it apart, and that promise that was made to be one flesh is no longer valid. You know, when hearts are described as hard in the Bible, It's often that people are unwilling to hear something. That's what the statement often means, hearts being hardened, people being unwilling to hear it. And so Jesus, at the end of the passage, verse 12, says, after the disciples say, well, if this is the case, then it's better not to marry. And Jesus says, let the one who is able to receive this receive it. Jesus knows not everybody is going to buy into this model of marriage. And as we look out at our world, we see staggering amounts of divorce and remarriage. We know this is true. Not everybody has bought into the model of marriage that God set from the beginning. But if there's one place where that model should be found, should it not be in the church? Should it not be among God's people? And that doesn't mean that we don't share in some of the same struggles with keeping a good marriage that the rest of the world finds in their marriages, but that means that we respond to things differently. We respond with forgiveness instead of vengeance. We think about the other more than the self. We have an opportunity to show the world what marriage should look like. As the rest of the world looks at divorce and even questions the ideal of marriage anymore, you may have heard people saying, is marriage even valid any longer? As people seek to redefine who can get married and what that looks like in society, and even celebrities now choosing to not be married simply because it no longer makes any meaning for them to be married, they'll just live together, have children together, and that's okay. As the world kind of muddies the waters of marriage, should it not be in the church where we get to be clear about what God has said and the health of relationship that comes from that? We have the opportunity to be the example of what the world should be like in marriage. We have dear friends, Abby and I do, back in Marysville. He is a couple. He is a professor at Ohio State University, Dairy Science Department. And Maurice works a lot with college students as a professor. He takes trips with them and goes on field trips and study abroad programs. And one particular occasion, Donna, his wife, was telling me about a story that happened when they were overseas in the Netherlands. They made a trip to the Netherlands to visit some dairy farms in Europe to see how dairy's done overseas. And it was a week-long, two-week trip, something like that. So it was a lot of time to interact. And as they were headed somewhere to go somewhere, they were talking, walking together, and Donna was with a group of girls, and they were asking her about her marriage. They respect Maurice a lot, and they wanted to know, what's it like? You know, how long have you guys been married, was one of the questions that they asked. And Maurice and Donna, something you have to know about Maurice and Donna is they got married at 18. They were high school sweethearts. And so they've been married for decades. I couldn't tell you how many, but a long time. And Donna told the girls how many years it was, and I couldn't tell you exactly how many, but it just shocked them. They're like, you've been married that long, how did you do it? They wanted to know, how did you do that? She started telling them, well, it's not easy. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's always been roses and peaches and all sorts of fun stuff. It's hard to get married and stay married for that long. But one thing that we decided when we were first married was that we were never going to allow divorce to be an option. We were never going to let that word be said. It was not going to be an option. And so the girls were starting to talk about this, and it really was an opportunity for Don and Maurice to share with them the promise that they made was for real. This wasn't till death is do us inconvenience or something of that kind of nature that it's not comfortable for me anymore in this marriage or they've changed or these kinds of reasons that we often give and not to give not to be flippant about some of those reasons that we sometimes struggle with remaining in a marriage as people do change and sometimes life happens and people make mistakes and do things that anger us and give us all of the anger that would justify in our minds the reasoning that we would want to divorce. But Maurice and Donna said, we didn't let that become an option. Henry Ford revolutionized the world in the early 1900s, not because he created the automobile, he wasn't the inventor of the automobile, but What Henry Ford did for the average American citizen was made it affordable to put a car in driveways through the automation, the factory system, parts going down an assembly line. Ford created the Model T and made it affordable for the average American citizen. Ford was also famous for being stubborn in some of the things that and what he wanted to see in his automobiles. When the popularity of the Model T was increasing and salesmen started to get excited about the sales and the things that they could do with this Model T and the options that they could tag on to this new product and the different things that they could offer, they came to Henry Ford and said, you know, we'd like to do this with the Model T. And Henry Ford is famous for having said, you can have it in any color, so long as it's black. What doesn't get talked about very much is that same stubborn attitude that carried him through 50 years of marriage. On his 50th wedding anniversary, somebody asked Henry Ford what his advice was for marital bliss and longevity. And he replied, just the same as in the automobile business. Stick to one model. In a crass kind of way, if we're going to stick to one model, we're going to have to fight for it. Marriage isn't easy. I don't intend to get up here and simplify marriage for you all and say it's always cut and dry, it's always easy to make these decisions about what to do. And I know you probably know that as well. However, the world is watching us. If the divorce rate does not change inside or outside the church, what does the world think about us? If we can't claim any difference among our people, among the followers of Jesus who makes these kinds of statements, what is the world going to think when they look at us? We have an opportunity to be salt and light, as we've talked about earlier in Matthew chapter 5, with the issue of marriage. And so it's going to mean that we fight for marriage. And so I'm going to challenge you this morning. If your marriage is struggling, please get some help. Talk to somebody about it. It's not a shameful thing. You don't need to act like you failed in life because your marriage is struggling. All of our marriages have struggled at some point or other. Let's be honest with each other. The only difference with those who make it and those who don't, well, I shouldn't simplify it that much, but what often happens is when our marriages do struggle is that we don't tell anybody until it's too late. Until we've made the decision. You talk to these elders, and they'll probably tell you stories of couples that have come into their office to talk to them about a marriage that they've already decided is over. And as much as they begged and pleaded and got on two knees and just asked them to please reconsider, it was already done and over with. Because oftentimes we wait until it's too late. We've made it up in our mind already. Let's be accountable to each other and let's get help. Because we need to make this journey starting and ending together. This morning, if you have any need to respond, we offer an invitation here in a moment that is given as a means of doing that, asking for help and asking for prayers. We'd love to pray for you. I know these men would love to pray for you in your marriage this morning if that's a need that you have. And it doesn't have to be up front. Let me tell you this too. It doesn't have to be in these next few minutes. If you want to come in Monday and talk to Keith or I about your marriage, we'd love to sit down and talk to you. Don't think that this is it. Or call Bob tomorrow evening. I'll make him available to you. Please talk to somebody about that. If you'd like to become a Christian this morning, if we can share anything about what it is to become a follower of Jesus, we'd love to do that as well. Why don't you come as we stand and as we sing?